This is Fresh Air. Richard Rodriguez has described himself as a comic victim of two cultures, Mexican and American. But in a time when preserving ethnic identity is emphasized, Rodriguez speaks with pride about assimilation. His parents are Mexican. He grew up in California. You may know him as an essayist for the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour. In his 1982 autobiography, Hunger of Memory, Rodriguez wrote about his reservations over bilingual education and affirmative action. He was criticized for identifying more with his American than Mexican heritage. In his new book, Days of Obligation, An Argument with My Mexican Father, Rodriguez returns to Mexico, considers his Mexican identity, and rethinks some of the positions from his first book. Immigrants and their children often worry about losing their cultural identity, but Rodriguez says it is self-destructive to protect your identity by limiting what you learn and expose yourself to.
When I talk to Hispanic young people, I always tell them, of course, you know, don't listen to people who tell you, you know, that you're losing your culture. For one thing, culture is not a suitcase or not a thing. It is not something static. Do not expect to have the culture of your parents. You know, I am not my father. He grew up in the state of Colima in western Mexico. The notion that I have lost his culture is, of course, inevitable. And uninteresting to say. The fact is that my culture is Lucille Ball. My culture is Walt Disney. My culture is Black America, is rap groups. My culture is Martin Luther King Jr. The notion that you lose your culture, I think, is one that freezes time and makes children afraid of the inevitability of their adulthood.
You received an excellent education, first in Catholic schools, and then you went to several universities for a BA and then graduate work, you know, with the help of scholarships. After college, you applied to teach at several universities, and you not only got a lot of teaching offers, you got offers with a lot of incentives to take those offers. But you ended up withdrawing your application from all the universities who made you offers. Why did you withdraw your application?
Call it white guilt. It turned out that Richard Rodriguez, when he started hearing himself described as a minority student, finally couldn't reconcile how his own movement into the middle class through education justified these benefits. And the scene I describe in my first book, Hunger of Memory, of being in Wheeler Hall in Berkeley one afternoon when a Jewish graduate student who was not getting job offers said to me, you know, once upon a time my grandfather applied to Harvard and was kept out because he was Jewish, and now I'm kept out of Harvard because I'm not Mexican. I had no answer to him. I also had no answer to those Mexicans who by their silence haunted me around the university, the gardeners, the janitors, the people one would see in cafeterias. Those people who, by their very exclusion from the institution, made me numerically a minority within the institution. How exactly was my presence, was my advancement related to their situation? More to the point, as America was busy in the last 20 years creating this artificial brown and black bourgeoisie, how exactly was our advancement related to the so-called inner city or to our home communities?
Okay, so you would have felt guilty accepting the positions because you thought you were being hired in a kind of affirmative action way.
Well, quite clearly, Terry. I mean, I was getting job offers at a time in which if you were white and you were male, there were no job offers.
Right.
And I was getting them unsolicited from places like Yale University, where you normally do not get unsolicited job offers.
Right.
And there was an easy ascendancy to all of this. I mean, you can tell me that I was talented, but I know my talent, and I probably belonged at a large state university somewhere, given a more equitable situation. The fact is that I was being propelled into the stratosphere at a point in my life when I simply couldn't justify that movement.
Is there anything inherently wrong with the impulse to keep university faculty multicultural, to have it be representative of different ethnic groups in America?
Well, I mean, first of all, that notion of multiculturalism seems to me to be either, seems to me, what shall I say? I mean, there is no multiculturalism in America. There is a culture in America which likes the idea of multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is a culturally biased term. It derives from some Canadian model of the I, the first-person pronoun. The notion in America, this Protestant notion that we have, we are, after all, a Protestant culture, that the most interesting thing about us is the fact that we are not one another. What I was struck with quite early, of course, is that there is an America here. Americans walk the same way. They are impatient at the fast food counter in quite the same way. They have the same kind of slouch. They all sound the same. And yet they all go on about multiculturalism. And there is not an American politician who would sit at this microphone and would tell you anything else except the fact that we are made better as a nation because we are diverse, that you are not me. Well, I have come here as a Mexican Catholic to tell you that, in fact, I am you. I'm Irish. I am Chinese. I live in a Chinese city right now, and I'm breathing their air, and they are changing me. And it is inevitable. You know what people say about dogs? If you get a dog, you better be careful what he looks like, because you're going to look like him after a while.
I appreciate what you're saying, but on the other hand, I mean, I think, like, for instance, any woman art student will tell you about the pressures she was under when she was one of the few women in the art class, and all the teachers were men. I know a lot of, you know, African American students feel like people don't quite get certain things that they feel when all the faculty members that they have are white. I mean, there is a certain amount of shared experience that you don't have with people who are of a different color or a different gender.
At the deepest level, you and I are not the same. I look into your eyes. You are my daughter. You are my mother. And I realize that there is an enormous gulf between us. Multiculturalism, if it is saying that about us, that we are finally isolated within the cell of our humanity, then I suppose I believe you. If you are telling me that by virtue of my Catholicism, by virtue of the fact that I'm homosexual, by virtue of the fact that I live in California, that I am different from you, by virtue of the fact that I'm male, et cetera, I'm arguing that as an American, that is within the notion of my Americanness, that I belong to some larger narrative that connects me to you, and that is the business of education to teach me. The other day I was in Las Vegas talking to some high school educators, and there was this school principal who came up to me after the talk. It was in one of these grotesque ballrooms. I think it was called the Versailles Ballroom. And he came up and he slapped me in the back afterwards. He said, you know, great talk, Dick, he said. He said, and this with a kind of note of congratulations in his voice, he said, you know, we don't have any white or black students in our school anymore. He said, we have only Asians and blacks, Asian and Hispanics. It has changed so radically in the last 10 or 15 years, he says. This is in the Southwest. And he says, you know, we don't have Black History Week anymore. We have Newcomers Month now. And I thought to myself, this is ludicrous. This is ludicrous. The notion that a Vietnamese child does not need to know the story of Black Americans, the notion that a Vietnamese or a Guatemalan child does not participate by virtue of being an American in that story is wrong, it seems to me, and trivializes both the experience of the Vietnamese child and his need to make sense of his Americanization.
My guest is Richard Rodriguez, and he's written a new book called Days of Obligation, An Argument with My Mexican Father. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Richard Rodriguez is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Days of Obligation, and of a previous book called Hunger of Memory. You may also know him as an essayist for the McNeil Lehrer NewsHour. When you were in college, there was a dean who said to you that he was certain after graduation you'd be able to work among your people. What did that mean to you? And when you think back on that, what does it mean to you now?
Well, I mean, what he meant, of course, is go back to East L.A. or wherever he thought I came from. In fact, my mother was very ambitious for our lives. And moved into a relatively white middle-class area of Sacramento, California, which is where I grew up. They are my people. And I stand, like you, in a classroom of inner-city kids as impressed as you would be by how little I can say, how different our experiences are, how different they are from me. I feel, frankly, easier in Mexico with the Mexican poor than I do with the American poor.
Why is that?
I don't know why, except that in some way, you know, that the Mexican poor remind me. I mean, normally they're my own family members, they are cousins and relatives, and there is not in Mexico that same sense that poverty distinguishes human beings, because Mexico doesn't read identity quite as economically as America does. You know, America is a country where we ask each other what we do for a living before we ask each other our family names. Mexico is a country that asks about family names.
I know that you don't feel that, you know, you represent the Mexican-American community, that you can be a spokesperson for, that they are your people and you are their role model. I want to ask you about another community and how connected or not you feel to it, and that's the quote, gay community. I'm putting that in quotes only because there's no one community. But
well, I put it in quotes, too. I always tell people that I'm not gay, that I'm morose.
But Do you feel part of that, quote, community? Do you know, or do you still have the same feeling that I am an individual, I speak for myself?
Well, you know, and it's curious that you phrase it in that way, because although I have been criticized in my writing for being this from the same people who would go on and on about being multicultural, by the way, that I'm too Catholic, that I'm too guilt-ridden, and that I'm too solemn in my homosexuality, that I should be, as the word says, more gay. In fact, you know, one of the interesting things that I saw in this city when I came back to San Francisco in the late 1970s was, of course, this extraordinary explosion of leisure and freedom and play that characterized the gay movement of the 1970s in San Francisco, the Castro District. And there I was, the skeptical gray man, even then in my 20s. What happened in San Francisco when the virus began in the 1980s, to take friends of mine, was, of course, that the culture was changed, and in some deep way, the American brashness of that first gay generation in this city, those people who'd come from Scotland and those people who'd come from Brooklyn and from Kansas to become someone new in California, they've had to face tragedy. The interesting thing was, of course, that within the tragic culture, there emerged a true community. There was the realization that we form a we. I'm caring for you. I promise you I will be here when you need me. I promise I will hold your hand when you die. There was a sense that we belong to each other, and there is now in San Francisco, at a time when so-called gay men and women are criticized by politicians for undermining family values, they are, in fact, the people who have the strongest family values that I know of in this city. A friend of mine, a woman who's just divorced, says, you know, the only happily married couples I know are all gay. And I know what she speaks of. She speaks of a friend of mine who nurses another friend of mine, these two men who are dying, though at different stages of the disease. And he bends over to kiss his lover, but realizes that his lover's face is so scarred that he has nowhere to plant his lips without harming his lover. And so he kisses his lover by brushing his eyelashes against his face. And I think to myself, nothing in the Brownings, nothing in the Romantics has taught me this kind of love, has taught me to watch the death of the young, nursing the young as they move toward death.
I know that you feel very deeply about your Catholicism. How do you feel that how do you deal with the fact that the Catholic Church really has not responded very positively to homosexuals? How do you reconcile that?
Well, when you say the church, you must realize that for those of us within the church is not so much a monolith. And the church is my mother. The church is this wonderful Jesuit priest who's one of my best friends, who makes this strange appearance in the book and leads me to the head of Joaquin Murrieta in Santa Rosa one summer afternoon.
So you can practice whether or not what the Pope has to say.
Well, I do as a Catholic, and here I admit to the Protestant influence in my life. I exist now as a Catholic within a culture of I do rely on conscience a great deal, much more than the Pope of Rome would like me to assert. But I remain comfortable within the church. I also remain, as I think the church also must recognize, a prophetic presence. That is, I think that the church is primitive in its understanding of sexuality, not simply homosexuality, but in its understanding of the married life. And I think in some sense that the lay community is a prophetic presence leading the church forward. We are not simply led by the clergy, quite clearly. I like all of those stories. The most brilliant one in my own life, the story of the Virgin Mary appearing as an Indian in Mexico to an Indian in 1531. I like the notion that she sends this Indian, Juan Diego, off to the Spanish bishop to convince him, basically to convert the Spaniard to her reality, that she appears as an Aztec. There are these stories throughout the history of the church of the clergy as being the last ones to get the point, as being the ones who need to be converted by the 12-year-old girl. And the church tells these stories on herself. And in that sense, I remain a Catholic. They cannot take it away from me. It is too much a part of my life. And to be a Catholic is really to belong to a tradition, to a community that does not simply rely on my ability to decide to be a part of or not to be a part of. As the old saying goes, once a Catholic, which is to say, I don't simply live within a Protestant possibility of saying, well, I reject all that I mean, it's not simply mine to reject. It has embraced me. It has created me. And in some basic way, the great tension in my life is not ethnic but religious. I'm a Catholic, a Mexican Catholic, in a secular Protestant country. The tensions that produces for me are much more rigorous at this moment than the tensions of ethnicity.
Well, Richard Rodriguez, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Richard Rodriguez has a new book called Days of Obligation, An Argument with My Mexican Father. This is Fresh Air.